Hello, this is a show from Radia. We're a group of stations bringing new and forgotten ways of making radio to our listeners. Each week we give artists the challenge to make radio that works across the whole of Europe and beyond. Are you up for it?
Hi, my name is Katharina Smets, and you will be listening to an audio essay I made on the basis of my book Between Me and You on the attitude of the audio documentary maker. It is about the space between the eye of the maker and the you of the interviewee, between the final work and the listener. It is an interpretation of my PhD thesis. And the music you will be hearing is by Inne Esremans. It all started in a suburb of Detroit. All the houses are built in the same beige bricks. They all have the same driveway with the same wide door. The grass is neatly trimmed, and in front of the houses the same mailboxes in the same beige. Harrison Township is a suburb of Detroit. I'm far from the city now. Here in the suburbs there's order. It's 2014 and I am here to interview someone for a series I'm making for the Dutch Radio on Detroit. I'm talking to artists about this city and I ask if art can help in any way when everything seems to be broken. I am about to do an interview that will be the starting point of my research. The reason why I wanted to take a closer look at the interaction between the reporter and the interviewee and study the motivation of the narrator and the maker of audio documentaries. So this is Ryder. Ryder is a writer, like his name states. He writes fiction and non-fiction about Detroit, the city he has lived in all his life. He should be able to tell me something about it, I think.
But I can put sugar if you want.
He's made coffee for me, with cake. Ryder is a thoughtful man. I wonder if Ryder is his real name.
I want you to have nice Detroit experiences.
Okay.
Not odd or, oh my God, I almost risked my life in Detroit. I want you to have some.
I think Ryder has forgotten this is an interview. I think he's asking me out.
Are you still recording me?
Of course, that's what I'm here for.
You're a pervert.
No.
So I'm asking you personal questions.
I'm going to put it off.
No. You, go ahead. Knock yourself out.
I think I'd better act more like a reporter. I ask what inspires him. Ryder starts quoting a poem by T.S. Eliot.
And would it have been worth it all after the cakes and the tea and ices as... After some talk of me and you, after the cakes and the tea and ices, to force the moment to its crisis, would it have been worth it all to roll the afternoon into a ball if one settling by a shawl should say, that is not what I meant at all, that is not what I meant at all. What he's trying to say in this beautiful poem, The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, is that he's getting up in years, his hair is balding, he's still single, he'd like to have a family, he'd like to have a girl.
Meanwhile, Ryder has taken my hand in his hands.
So he's saying, okay, I'm going to go to this dinner party, the first hot chick I'm going to see, I'm just going to say, let's get out of here and go for a walk while the evening is spread out against the sky like a patient being etherized upon a table.
The great fear of the man in the poem is that the woman doesn't really care, that it's all just a formality.
What if when she asked me how I was doing, she didn't really mean how was I doing? She didn't really care. It's just something perfunctory. What if I tell her how I'm really doing and she says, that is not what I meant at all. That is not it at all.
I try to get the conversation back on track and ask where Ryder writes.
Well, Katharina, this is the special Visconti pin, the Vetrino pin. the drug pipe paraphernalia, the crack pipe. Where's the crack pipe? I seem to have misplaced my crack pipe. This is one of my guns. And then,
one of your guns?
Yeah.
How did that feel to handle a gun? I have no idea how it must feel.
Well, let's change that.
Writer opens his wardrobe.
And
slides his clothes aside.
Look that way.
A safe. And then he pulls out his collection of guns.
Oh my
and
God.
His photo camera.
It's not really a big deal.
Okay.
And always when you shoot a shotgun, the first thing you do immediately is wreck, because it knocks the other shell out.
My hands are sweaty.
Yeah? Okay.
I've never held a gun before.
Just shoot!
So I look at, in one straight line.
Oh, hold on, you're blushing. Let me get a picture of you blushing.
You're going what? Sorry?
You're blushing. I'm going to get a picture of you. You turn like three shades of red. Okay, now pick something.
Okay, I'm pointing at the...
Anything.
Point at me.
No,
I don't
point at... It's okay, point at me.
Okay, over your shoulder.
Oh, no, me. Right in the chest. Point to my chest. There we go.
Oh, God.
Chest, not arm. I don't want to be... I need my arm. Okay, ready?
I try to imagine the picture Ryder is taking now. You look straight down the barrel of my rifle that I'm holding in my sweaty hands, along with the microphone.
Okay. Go. Go.
So I pull the trigger.
Yeah?
I can't.
Pull the trigger. Do you want to do the interview? Do you want to do the fucking interview?
Okay.
Pull the trigger. Go on.
This is not what I meant at all. This is not it at all. Before I leave, Ryder asks if I will tell anyone about him. That he won't exist until I tell his story. And I remember thinking, I don't think I exist until I can tell my story about this experience too. This work is only real when I also talk about myself in this situation. But what is this work that we do? I asked the acclaimed journalist and audio documentarian John Buwen from the Center of Documentary Studies at Duke University. John works in this field for 40 years now, but is also an essayist on this very subject. So I called him.
Documentary is where art and journalism meet. So what does it mean? The journalism part means it's factual. It's not just fiction. You can't lie to the listener. You can't deceive the listener. The sound that the listener hears, if it's being presented as being real sound from the world, it should be real sound from the world. But the art part is that it can absolutely be creative. You can play. You can bring in subjectivity. You can state your opinion, but you can also... It could be very elliptical, montage-y, creative, inventive, all in the service of telling a deeper and more subtle and more nuanced truth.
There are no rules other than telling the truth. But I wanted to think about my place in the process. First, I wanted to understand what my relationship as a maker is with the world. What do I bring? How do I relate to the people I interview? And what is at the heart of our encounter? Secondly, I wanted to understand what relationship I want to establish with the listener. So at the beginning of my research, I have had conversations with makers about their attitude towards the use of their voice in the documentary work, showing their autobiographical selves or not.
When did you start using yourself? Was it always there?
I spoke to makers like the Canadian Jonathan Goldstein and Caitlin Prest, and the Danish Rikke Hout.
I think I've always used myself in my work. I've always felt like starting with I was an open acknowledgement of something that both, you know, I and the audience already know, in a way, that the broadcast isn't coming from some kind of omniscient gas, you know, that there's a person who's telling them a story, and hopefully the acknowledgement of this makes what's to follow feel more genuine and authentic.
It was easier to ask myself to do that than it was to ask other people, because I basically had already dedicated my life to doing that. And I felt like it was important, and I had a really clear sort of, like, you know, ethical and creative imperative for why it was important. And I believed in it. So it was a lot easier to put myself in that vulnerable position than it was to ask other people to do it.
I was trained in the Danish feature department. And when I started there in the late 90s, around 2000, there wasn't a lot of use of the first-person narrator. Actually, there wasn't a lot of use of narrator at all. But then I made a story with a cryptic eye, and I used very little details. It was a lyrical eye that could set the borders of the story, I felt, but not that much that it became realistic.
Like me, the makers I spoke to recognized the subjective gaze in their work. There is always a person at the controls, and an objective point of view is difficult to live up to. Inspired by them, I thought it would be a good idea to take a deep dive in the autobiographical voice. I started experimenting with the literary genre. In the first months of my research, I made Menuet for BBC Radio 3, about my own heartbreak at the time, and memories of my grandmother in Poland. I was talking to a you that is not present, weaving my personal memories and mixing up timelines. The train crawls slowly towards Antwerp station. There's graffiti on the walls, stars, insects, and name tags. My grandmother used to know all the names of stars and constellations. There are strange towers next to the tracks, in yellow and brown stone, to lead you in another world. That was the idea of the architect more than 100 years ago, that these little towers would lead you into another world of glass and steel, medieval and modern at the same time. There is a zoo just next to the station. Sometimes, if the wind is right, you can hear a roar in the distance. A wild animal of some kind, I'm never quite sure. Maybe it's the echo that carries the sound. The train ducks underground and all goes dark for a second. White specks of light. And then, all of a sudden, the enormous hall. Some people say this is the most beautiful railway station in the world, with its staircase like a waterfall, leading to the main hall like a ballroom of steel and glass. You and me, we had this unspoken agreement. No matter how long or short the trip, you would be waiting for me in the station. Your place in the hall is empty now. The first thing I gave you was a keyring. A tiny plastic tube with yellow liquid and a tiny bubble of air. If you'd keep it leveled in your hand, the air would be suspended in the middle, an empty space between us. The second thing I gave you was the key to my house. Because I don't own a lot of stuff, I could only give you space, empty space, to fill in my fridge, my closet, my bookshelf, in my kitchen. And now your stuff is gone, I don't seem able to fill the empty shelves again. We agreed on seeing each other one last time. I would shout, and my voice would crack. I never shout. I'm not used to shouting. Be honest. That's what you said. This is honest. Honest. My angry voice bounced off the walls. The echo carried the sound. And then I flipped my middle finger, something I don't do often. Flip is a wrong word for it, actually. It seemed more like I was throwing something up in the air, something I was hoping you would catch. My grandmother reads the same book over and over again, about gods and half-gods.
Postacie podań greckich nazywamy bohaterami lub herosami.
It's a worn-down purple paper bag of Greek mythology.
Zazwyczaj byli to synowie bogów, urodzeni z kobiety śmiertelnej. Aha, bo bogowie mieli kontakty z kobietami.
She used to read these stories to me when I was little.
A tu wyprawa Argonautów.
Tak.
Pamiętasz?
Tak, tak, tak.
Strange and familiar to me at the same time.
Pamiętam też, jak czytałeś mi o Odysseusie.
Odysseus. That's her favorite character.
Odysseus?
No.
On dobry typciu. Odysseus.
She joked about not remembering what she read a moment ago. So now she can read it over and over again. Now I read it to her.
Nie?
No.
I walk out of the station. The gold and diamond shops are closed. A man with a large fur hat passes me in the sliding doors. It's quiet in the streets of Antwerp. Café de Clock plays the same songs over and over for the last customers. Sitting at a safe distance from each other, staring at their beer. The air is clear. It's one of the first nights freezing. The lights are lit in the streets now, and I know boats are passing quietly over the river. We used to sit there in a bend, watching the night fall and the industry light up. The flames of the petrochemical industry in the harbor would light up the towers. I pass the zoo and I can see the contours of the giraffes shivering in the fog. My breath makes little clouds. One night, my grandmother wakes me up.
Słyszysz, babciu?
I'm staying with her in a tiny house on the Polish countryside, next to the wilderness.
Tam. Tam, dobrze, owczarni, tam.
Tak, tak.
Jest za zimno.
Nie, a zobacz, jakie piękne.
It's a cold fall night. You can see everything when it's so clear, my grandmother says. All those stars. I used to remember the names of the stars and the constellations.
Gwiazd.
ile gwiazd się popatrzy.
Nie całkiem to widzę, ale domyślam się, że tutaj jest.
We are standing in the dark, in our nightgowns.
Ale piękne są.
Ile tego jest?
No jest.
And then a loud roar from a distance.
O, jeszcze odpowiedź.
A red deer, perhaps.
Ale to dosyć blisko.
No.
It sounds so close, my grandmother says.
Gdzie to może? Albo tak echo niesie spod lasu.
Or maybe it's the echo that carries the sound.
Ło.
Making this, I was in control. I was alone in my editing room, deciding about everything, making a piece that perhaps someone would listen to in solitude. It was intimate, but at a safe distance. I wanted audio documentaries I made to be more than just my experiences of encounters concentrating on the self. Moreover, myself remained unknowable to me. The more I focused on the I, the more it seemed to retreat further and further away, just as I tried to grasp it. I was also not quite sure how to relate to the people I was interviewing and whose stories I was using in my work. Did I have an accountability to the world I was portraying? What dynamics were at play between myself as a maker and the person I was interviewing, or whose voice I was using? After my biographical work, I was searching, and I had no language to describe exactly what happened next, or what I wanted to happen. I did, however, feel the dynamic pull in the space between an I and a you. So let the pendulum swing to the other side now, to the you. To understand better what was going on between this I of the maker and the you of the people I was interviewing, I reached for a book I picked up at the beginning of my research, but didn't seem to be ready for at the time. I and Thou by Martin Buber. In the years that followed, I would occasionally see it somewhere on a bookcase. Those three simple words glaring out to me, I and Thou. 4 years later, almost at the end of my research, and after many detours around extreme autobiographical work, but never quite sure if I was finding what I was looking for, and later a complete focus on the interviewee and almost a full removal of myself, I finally opened that book again. Only then I began to understand how the I cannot exist in isolation. When there is an I, a you of the interviewee emerges. And, simultaneously, the you of the listener. Reality is a dialogical relationship that takes place entirely in the area between I and you, in an open space accessible to both, an open space between us. I think I found my own attitude in the exchange with the other, to enrich my view of the world. Looking ahead, I see myself more audibly present in my work again. Unfiltered, just as I hope for the same sincerity from the people I interview. I asked one of the people I talked to for years to look back at our experience together. A few days ago, I called Jerry Lemieux from Detroit, and I asked how the experience of me interviewing him was for him.
In the beginning, I was just happy to meet you. There is something about you that makes me want to talk. And it's your personality and your genuine curiosity about me and about others. And so I was hooked right on. I mean, you could have asked me anything, to do anything. And I pretty much did. And was happy to be part of the story you wanted to tell.
But you didn't feel tricked?
No, I didn't feel tricked because I felt like I knew you. You wouldn't try and trick me in some way that was unfair. I mean, you were telling me that you would like this and that you trusted me to pull it off. You know, you trusted me to pull it off more than I trusted myself. So I just followed your lead. You were asking me to be vulnerable. And I did it because I felt safe with you. You know, the whole time we were developing a relationship. And so it kind of evolved. And I found that it was helpful for me to remember. You know, even when it was painful, it was also helpful. I got very emotional. It wasn't embarrassing. I'm not afraid to cry. I wanted it to be true. And even my emotions were part of the truth.
Looking into the future, I want to continue experimenting with my own fragility as a lyrical storyteller, starting from lived experience and open to vulnerability. In the production processes of my performances and podcasts, I noticed that it was necessary to show myself. A more visible I creates a clearer dynamic with a you. This storyteller, this I, is shaped by history, defined by rules of expression, rules that are handed down from literature, from theater, from broadcasting. This I will not hide that context, but I will pursue a flexibility that leads the listener away from well-trodden paths. It is an I that can shape and structure the narrative as a poem, a metaphor, or a legend. To expose a landscape that is not yet cultivated, but one in which we can presume the existence of new narratives. It is the possibility of a story as a home, where you and I can live together.
End of transmission. Find us on the internet, radia.fm. Over and out.